This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. With marijuana legalization just 6 months away, who's going to be most inclined to use it?
People that have probably, experimented in their youth, that might be getting close to retirement age like myself.
Mike Williams from Mother Murphy's talks to GLT's Mary Cullen about running a head shop in a new era. Plus, there are too many beds available in state boot camp programs. Another look at the downside of DNA technology. Sometimes it's too easy to collect too much. And normal council member Kevin McCarthy stops by to unpack what's in a name and other issues. All that and a GLT news update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The Normal Town Council has voted 4-2 to approve a name change from Mitsubishi Motorway to Rivian Motorway. The resolution expresses support for Rivian in its efforts to build its brand and attract investors. The mayors of Bloomington and Normal join us most Tuesdays after their regular and special council meetings. Mayor Chris Koos is out of town at a workshop on municipal issues. Joining us to talk about the Rivian name change and other issues is Councilmember Kevin McCarthy, who ran last night's meeting. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Charlie. Glad to be here.
Changing Mitsubishi Motorway to Rivian Motorway, what's the practical effect? What message does that send?
Well, I think from a local perspective, we've got a company who's, in all accounts, saved an auto plant from closing and is already at about 75 jobs and looking to add somewhere in the neighborhood of 500 to 1,000 jobs over the course of the next decade. And already invested some $20 million in the plant on the way to, $40 million or higher. And it's a small way that our local community can show our local support by changing it from the former company's name to the current company's name.
Is that really meaningful support?
Well, I guess you'd have to put yourself in the position of Rivian Automotive. Do you want your address to be Mitsubishi Motorway when you're Rivian and you're bringing in whatever level of guests or investors or whoever, for it not to say Rivian? Is it symbolic? Yes, of course it is. Does it have some tremendous value beyond symbolism? There's some. I can't quantify that for you. But certainly to show a concrete show of local support that we believe in Rivian, that we're happy that they're here, and obviously they're a startup, and so we're pulling for them and rooting for them, and we're very happy to obviously hear about their two big funding recent investments.
Council member Stan Nord raised concerns about GPS misguidance, business disruption of customers who can't find the place of a business on the new Rivian Motorway or get mail. What do you think of those objections?
I think, any technical change involves some time to get it all right. When I moved a couple of businesses from Bloomington to Normal, the U.S. Postal Service was great with alias forwarding services and actually was better than I anticipated them to be. Does that mean it's 100% going to change all the time without glitches? No, it doesn't. So will there be some? Yes, but I think it's important. There's some great information shared in the packet that IDOT's process will involve re-signing the highway over a 30 to 45 day window before it's official. And I think, one of the things that we have to keep in mind is that it's Route 150, and it's always been Route 150, and it'll never change. And a lot of the addressing is based off Route 150 rather than Mitsubishi Motorway. That's a more local thing rather than a interstate thing. And so from an interstate perspective, 150 will continue to be used and always has been used. And so that won't change. And I think that was lost last night a little bit in the discussion. Is that we're not changing Route 150 at all, and it'll continue to be used for large scale direction finding, is my understanding. But locally, I think that if you're trying to find the IRS building, you're going to look for the IRS building in Bloomington Normal, and you're going to get a direction to the IRS building, whether it's Mitsubishi Motorway or Rivian. So I think, you know, certainly there's the potential for some glitches, but as a long-term problem, I don't see that as a problem at all.
We're going to go back to some council issues in a second, but let's depart and talk philosophy of place names a little bit.
Okay.
What is, in your view, the importance of place names in a community? Why are they important? What are we trying for when we, as a community, stick a label on a street, an avenue, a park, a whatever?
Well, I think, you know, on some level, it depends on what it is. If we're, you know, in this particular instance, right, we're acknowledging the largest, most significant address and job and economic investment in our community. And so, this is the most significant thing that has happened in the area in decades, and likely will be for quite a long time. And so, on that scale, I think it's a very reasonable thing to do. Now, if you're starting to talk about minor roadways and historical references, you know, that's, I think, a different conversation and somewhat at the feel of the community, right? And so, there's off in the county, I can think of one road that's named after a law enforcement professional.
Sure, who died in a tragic accident in the line of duty, in service to the public. We name them for prominent politicians, Obama Roadway or Vince DiMuzio, who is a former state senator from Carlinville, the
Absolutely.
Area of ICE. I-55 down to St. Louis is named for him. There's county board members get names on roads if they've spent several decades of solid service sometimes, mm-hmm. and depending on the regard in which they're held. The culture of the time determines that. A lot of cities have presidents' names on certain and certain presidents, and not certain other presidents. It depends on who's in power at the time at the city council level.
Mm-hmm.
When they're making these choices, when you're making these choices, what do you think is important?
So, again, we're talking philosophy, so at the 10,000-foot level versus this. You know, obviously, the criteria for me was I've got a major employer who's got a former manufacturer's label on the street in front of their address. I think, obviously, we want to do something about that, and the specifics for me here is, you know, millions in investments and hundreds, if not thousands, of jobs potentially being created here, and keeping a 2.5 million square foot manufacturing facility open and generating property taxes for our school districts. When you start to look at the enormity of the consequence of what Rivian is doing, that is an easy decision. So those are some of the criteria.
Mm-hmm.
On the large scale, obviously, it's got to be community, you know, contextually relevant. So,
what kind of message should communities try to send? Should they say, here's a bunch of dead white male presidents? Should they say, these were leaders who gave the nation and the community something worthwhile? Should they say, oh, this is a lovely place and we'll call this Lavender Avenue or whatever? I mean, what should be a filter for these decisions?
Yeah, you know, that's interesting. You know, there's an Irish development on the southeast side, and so, you know, Gaelic place, and there's...
That's another question. Do councils often abrogate that decision to developers who want to create a marketing tool for themselves?
So you're reading my mind. And so, as I understand it in the time that I've been on council, that's usually at the developer level, right? And so we're usually not involved in the naming of streets in a PUD, right? And a final plat, there's no names typically on those streets. It just shows streets. And then magically, when there's houses, there's street names. And that usually happens at the developer level. At the council level, we only get involved typically if there's a name change, right? And so if something is initiated as Martin Luther King, obviously that typically does not have a council involvement unless a roadway gets changed to that. And then typically the municipal government gets involved. And then again, I'm going to say that's about, you know, the cultural value set of the community. And so, you you know, obviously, you know, Abraham Lincoln was a big, important person here in the history of Bloomington Normal. If a Lincoln way were decided, I think the community value set would be embracing of that change. And I guess that's where I'm going with it. Depends on.
Yeah, we already got a couple Lincolns, actually.
But you get my point.
Absolutely.
So I think if we're talking about, you brought up dead presidents and you brought up that. So if we're talking about historical significant figure, I think it's going to be figures that have some relevance to a community, right? And so, but over time, is that individual still viewed positively, or has the community temperature changed?
Or are they forgotten entirely? Yeah. How many people actually know who the heck Jesse Fell was, you know?
You'd be surprised, actually.
Fell Avenue, you know?
You'd be surprised. There's a lot of people that still know the Fell history with Illinois State University. Some people know his penchant for fruit trees and the like. Most people still know that there's some connection between Illinois State University and Abraham Lincoln as well. What exactly that is, it's interesting how that all fits together, I would say, is probably fading. But
and when does it age out? And when is it ripe for either renaming to something that has a current value to the community, or perhaps you say, okay, it's permanent because we've had generations of experience with this name?
Yeah, I think, you know, a community can only know that, right? And your nod to who's on a council and what the contemporary topics are facing the council or wanting to be addressed by the council of whatever community we're talking about. So it's got to be community value-based, and it's got to be relevant at the time. And so I don't think that anybody's just going to pick that street and go, why is that street named that? We should change it to something else just because they don't like the name of the street. I haven't seen that done. I don't know. Maybe that'll happen. But I think usually there's some impetus behind it. Like, for instance, this action, there's an impetus. We have a major manufacturing business change, and we have the old name of the old business there. And obviously there's a pretty strong impetus to change that.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Kevin McCarthy of the Normal Town Council about the meeting and other issues. We've been talking about the importance of names. What's in a name? A rose by any other name would smell as sweet. I had to get that in there. There is another aspect to the naming issue from last night we should touch on, though. Karen Smith and Stan Nord read their packets. They prepared. In that packet was information from staff that detailed efforts to contact the businesses and find out their concerns, if any, about the change. Yet that still came up as a concern by Karen Smith. The utility of raising questions to which the answer is known. You can argue that it's to demonstrate to the public the processes of government. The downside that in a business meeting it takes extra time. In this case, it took 33 minutes to decide a name change, or two name changes. How do you think those considerations about efficiency versus demonstrating publicly the integrity of the process should be balanced?
You know, I'm one person on the council, and I've got one perspective, and so I'm certainly not going to speak on behalf of the entirety. So, you know, obviously the staff historically and to this day puts great effort to give us great information so we can make good decisions. And so, you know, when I first came to the council, Charlie, 7 years ago, I read every single word of everything that I could get my hands on. And I remember one packet at the end of a 86-page development agreement finding the word condo when it was supposed to be apartment, and getting an odd look from then city manager Mark Peterson about why I would be reading the 86-page development agreement. For me, preparing is very important. It's part of my job. I tend to be a chronic over-preparer, but and so for me, it's important when I come to a meeting that I know everything that's in that packet. I know all the information, and that gives me the opportunity to ask additional questions ahead of time if I don't know the answers. So is it valuable to rehash in public what's already been put out to the public, I suppose. I don't always think that some of the choices are worthwhile. Is it important to have discussion on the issues? Absolutely. You know, you'll never hear me say not. But each individual person has to make that decision. Does it cost additional dollars to the taxpayers? Absolutely, it does. When you have staff there till, you know, super late at night with items that are already known, costs tax time or taxpayer dollars to pay those staff and do additional research. So, you know, it's all part of the governmental process. But for me, being very well prepared, knowing that information before, so I don't have to ask known information when I come to the council meeting, and I can have a discussion from that fact set forward rather than backwards, is really important to me.
Well, Councilmember Stan Nord says he questions expenses and staff actions in public as spot checks, even though he could be doing that in private before meetings. Indeed, he says he sends staff questions that he plans to ask ahead of time. Is that a good process, to do that in public when he could be getting the answers in private ahead of time and answer his questions? How does that move things forward if he's asking the same questions in public?
Yeah, I don't know. You're going to have to ask him what he believes that value to be. Certainly, if there's been a public discussion about expending money in a certain direction or a certain thing, you know, calling that out to have a discussion about that, if it's been part of a broader discussion, is certainly worthwhile, right? And so, and that's why we're super transparent about putting everything that we're spending out. And so I don't necessarily understand the strategy of voting no on bills. I hope we're not suggesting that the town of Normal shouldn't pay its bills. So I don't really understand that approach, but I certainly asked questions about the bills, particularly when I was new. I did it in private, so they had the opportunity to get back to me and answer, and there could be an iterative process. Occasionally, I would ask about expenditures, part of like MFT spending and how the timing of the funds released and all of that. I think those are certainly appropriate funding questions to ask, but those are separate items from the bills. But so the value, you're going to have to ask Mr. Nord why he feels that is as valuable as he seems to be making it.
He thinks that there's value in demonstrating it in public. Does it have a downside other than taking the extra time and extra staff time and money to perform it? Or is it corrosive to public belief in government or affirming to public belief in government to have that demonstrated and questioned in that way?
Well, I think, you know, that's a very complex issue you're asking. And does anybody really know the entire mind of the public on that? But I'm going to take a little different tact in answering that, I think. So how do we instill trust from the public in what we're doing financially? And so I think it certainly begins with a very public budget process. And so we do that in three phases: property tax, capital improvement plan, and then the operating budget. And all of those are done in public meetings with lots of public meeting notice. The media is invited. Some of you guys show up for some of those.
Now and again.
So some of those 4, 5, 6 hour meetings that we have. But the important part is whether or not you're there is that everybody, I mean everybody, has the opportunity to come in and view it and see it. And then after the fact, when the votes are taken and the decisions are made, that information is available to the public. And so notice, invitation for inclusion, and the availability of that information is certainly the ticket to entry to earn public trust. We have to do those three things, in my estimation: public process, opportunity for inclusion, and then availability of information. And what that does, I think, allows anybody to approach me or anybody in the council or senior staff to be able to ask questions because the information is available. And so, frankly, in 7 years, I've gotten very few questions on the bills. Very, very few. Does that mean that there's no questions out there? Not necessarily, but it hasn't been a large topic of concern for citizens, for me, over two elections.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. With us today is Councilmember Kevin McCarthy, standing in for Mayor Chris Coos, who's out of town. The council just recently held a retreat to talk about healthy processes. What are some of your takeaways from that, and what happens next?
So we're still early in the process, and so it was a retreat work session for us to begin to define what good governance looks like from the council perspective. And so separate from...
And some of that is part of what we just talked about, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And so, you know, separate from the politics of running for the office, now that you're in the chair, how do we govern effectively? And so certainly, you know, part of the work was looking at how do we define success as a council? What's the image in the community we want to have and the role we want to play in the community as elected officials?
Is there broad agreement about what defines success among council members?
Yeah, so our work sessions are fast and furious, and they help us to digest a large volume of items and topics and information and distill that down into a level of agreement. And it's very democratic. We rank and we vote and we order items, and so by that process then come to a consensus about what happens, what those value sets are, what those rules are for what we do.
And is there broad agreement?
So far, again, we're very early in the process. I don't even have the draft product back yet from our work, and so that's still being distilled down into. We saw it at the outcome. I can't spit that out. There was a bunch of information over many hours, what I expect to get back is a draft version of, you know, certainly how we chose to define success from a council perspective. What the role is we want to have in the community as elected officials, and kind of our code of conduct and civility for how we conduct ourselves as a governing body.
So what are some elements of that code?
So certainly, you're going to ask me to dig into my memory banks, and that's
just
okay.
A couple. Yeah. I am not expecting a comprehensive thing. As you said, it was a long, complex process. But
yeah, so
give listeners a flavor for the kinds of things that you're valuing.
You know? And I'm happy to do that from my recollection. And so my recollection of that portion of the discussion was about respect, about professionalism, about what does working as a team mean, and how we do that, listening before talking, being attentive and good listeners, all the things that we would, when we say respect for process, respect for team, that we would think about. I'm sure there's a good athletic analogy. I don't have one off the top of my head right now, but understanding that we all have a role and are a part of a team, but we're not the only player on the team, and that we're one of seven, and that we're one opinion of seven, and that to get to make progress and continue to evolve and be a great place where people want to live, that we have to find a way to bring those seven perspectives together in a respectful way, disagree when we need to. But do that in a disagree without being disagreeable was one of our mantras as part of it.
That's been a mantra for years.
Yeah, but to be able to go forward. So, you know, not personally attacking each other, trying to set aside egos, and look for compromises to get to yes, which was the important part.
So is this particularly important now? That you have two new council members, or is there a huge utility for existing council members to go through this?
Well, I think it's both. You know, every time I go through this, right, the faces have been a little different. And so I think leveraging the experience of some of us who've been around for a while in that process, but also hearing what some of the new faces and members have to say And because as people evolve on the council, right, there's changes to value set, changes to visions. And so I think that as a governing body evolves, as a community evolves, the perspectives have to evolve with it. So, yeah, I think there's important to have an eye towards what was done and the hard work and what has worked toward evolving to evolving priorities and evolving values.
Do you believe the current council dynamic is a healthy one and that people are following those rules of civility and team, or are there widely divergent views of what government should be accomplishing on the council?
You know, I that's a hard one. And so every time there's somebody new, and I'm sure when I was brand new and my first meeting, when I sat down, I'm sure there were some people shaking their heads about whatever I said in that first month or two. And so there's certainly a learning curve for sitting down in a chair like this. It's a tremendous responsibility. There's some pretty heavy, weighty decisions that you make.
So when can we expect you to actually have a conclusion and stop saying, let's wait and see?
Well, I don't know that I'm saying wait and see. I suppose
a year.
So a wide, clearly, there's a bigger diversity of opinion and operating styles on this council than there's been in the most recent past. In some ways, we're getting bogged down by process and procedural stuff that I think will work better over time, right? And so some of the public questioning of things that are already known, I think that's starting to curtail some by beginning to understand process. The mechanics of how we move things forward, I think, are we're stumbling less on those things and having more substantive conversations about the topics themselves and, to your point, philosophy from your earlier question. I hope we continue in those ways.
Normal Councilmember Kevin McCarthy, thanks for your time today on Sound Ideas.
Thank you, Charlie. Always a pleasure.
The mayors of Bloomington Normal join us most Tuesdays after their regular and special council meetings. Occasionally we get a designated hitter if one of the mayors is out of town, and we had one today from Kevin McCarthy. Next week you'll hear from Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 and WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting's Community Service Grant and from a grant from the Illinois Arts Council Agency. These grants help fund Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and other programming on which you depend for news, information, and entertainment. Additional support comes from GLT contributing listeners. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, the state of Illinois has a problem with its boot camps, an IPR report. Governor J.B. Pritzker made good on his promise when he signed recreational cannabis into law last month. While anticipation runs high among Illinois residents, smoke shops across the state are preparing for what they hope is an influx of customers. GLT's Mary Cullen spoke with the owner of one of America's oldest head shops, nestled in Uptown Normal. Mike Williams runs Mother Murphy's with his wife, Becky.
Mother Murphy's was opened by Betty and Charlotte, Betty Anderson and Charlotte Ratka, back in 1968 to cater to the growing hippie nation. It was kind of reaching the Midwest a little later than the coast, but it was the first shop that would set up and sell black lights and posters and smoking accessories, as well as they were specializing in silver and leather and things like that. That was very popular fad wear, you know, for hippies and such back in when I was young, just a kid. Mother Murphy's has been going for 51 years now, and it's been almost in the same location except for 2 years. But we're carrying on the tradition that those ladies started way back then.
Now, we know cannabis isn't legalized yet. Medical marijuana is legalized in the state. There are medical dispensaries for that purpose. So what are you allowed to sell since cannabis is not yet legalized now?
Well, As far as selling smoking accessories go, we've never stopped selling smoking accessories. We kind of pulled back with some of the styles of water pipes and things in the 80s and things, but we've always sold smoking accessories, and the truth about it is that anything that can be smoked with tobacco can also be used with marijuana. They're totally interchangeable, and so the law has to be based on intent, which is much harder to prove. But as far as the new laws, when the medical passed and the dispensary opened, we kind of talked with some of the people that were running the medical dispensaries, and were offering medical patients, if they had a medical card, 10% discounts on their smoking accessories. And as far as the new laws goes, we're very excited about that, because we figure there's probably going to be a lot of people that would be reluctant to maybe try in the past because of the law, as well as people that have probably experimented in their youth, that might be getting close to retirement age like myself, and that maybe want to try it again. So I expect there will be a rise in use and probably a rise in sales of smoking accessories, I'm certainly hoping.
Now, when it comes to the legalization of cannabis, there's a lot of discussion on whether or not it actually increases the people who smoke marijuana or ingest marijuana in any way, or if it's just people who were doing it in private before and are no longer, you know, keeping it to themselves. What do you think on that?
Well, I feel like it's going to be both. I think people are going to be, you know, trying it maybe for the first time. I think people might I know people that probably use marijuana instead of alcohol, you know, and they feel like it's less harmful to their health in so many ways, as well as society. But and the same with even cigarettes, you know, they have an urge to smoke, but they don't need to smoke all day every day on cigarettes, and they could just have a little bit of I don't know, lung action or something occasionally.
So for your business at Mother Murphy's, are you seeing a change in business? Are you planning on carrying any extra drug paraphernalia, anything of that sort that'll change what you carry presently?
Not really. We're quite established with all the different products we sell, and we'll certainly increase the product lines or quantity as business increases, as I hope will happen.
What about selling marijuana? Have you considered getting a dispensary license?
I haven't checked into it yet, and I know it's probably very expensive to both apply as well as stock, you know, to afford the stock of that. I'm not sure if I'll be able to do it, but I'll probably be looking into it. My wife and I are getting a little older, and frankly, we're thinking about retiring, you know, and we'd like to see the Mother Murphy tradition continue on, you know, so maybe we'll be able to find somebody out there that wants to carry the tradition on.
Mother Murphy's may be one of the oldest head shops with a steady clientele, but Smoker's Euphoria is one of the new kids on the block. Co-owner Javelin Lawrence tells GLT her take on a head shop is less about smoke and more about smart.
Smoker's Euphoria, we are head / vapor shop. However, our customer base are a little bit different than your average smoke shop. We cater more to medicinal cannabis patients. So our patients come in to get more education in regards to cannabis or CBD.
So you don't necessarily have a direct tie to the recreational marijuana users. As you mentioned, you focus on, you know, vaping and medical users. So what are your thoughts on how the legalization of recreational use could impact your shop?
In general, I think that it would be a benefit just from the standpoint of being able to purchase items that a recreational consumer would need. However, even though we will provide those things, we will still focus more on the educational part of it. If you were to come to buy a particular item, we would want to explain to you how to use it and how to effectively use the product to get the most medicinal value out of the product, more so than just smoking to smoke. So for us, we really focus on the education part of cannabis.
Could you explain how there is the education aspect? You know, what is something that you might attempt to teach someone who comes in wanting to buy something who is a recreational user? What's something that maybe they'd need to know?
Well, for the average person that comes in who would like to purchase, for example, a water pipe, we want to make sure that they're getting enough filtration in so they're not getting as much carcinogens in their lungs, and also make sure that they understand how to clean it properly and how to use it effectively. Also, if they choose to use a device rather than, say, a water pipe, we want to make sure they understand the right temperature to smoke at it so that they get the most medicinal value out of it versus just smoking it and not understanding that the higher temperatures, they're not going to get as much out of it as they would if they were to burn it with a regular lighter. So we would want to educate them more on that level.
And can you explain what some of those medicinal benefits would be?
For a cannabis user, for example, I have multiple sclerosis. So for me, smoking is not necessarily the best value that I would get out of cannabis. I prefer more tinctures. So then I would want to make sure that they're getting the right amount of tinctures that they need for their body based on their weight and based on the severity of their disease. So for them, I would, you know, calculate if you get this much CBD, how much should you have, and make sure that they're getting that in, and I also make sure they're getting that amount in. And then I'll also encourage them to keep a journal. That way they know if a product is effective for them. So they would know what strands they have, how much they're consuming, how they felt before they had taken it, how they felt afterwards. And by keeping the journal, they're able to see the benefits of it. Because most people, when they take something, 10 minutes later, you forget why you've taken it, or you forget if you don't feel pain because you just assume that it's working. And some people don't always know that it's working. But if they see over time and they can track, then they'll be able to know if it's working for them or not. And then if it's not working for them, then we can switch to a different product.
You mentioned at the beginning of this conversation that your shop is catered toward the medical users of cannabis. Obviously, recreational use is not legal yet. When it is, it's not like you're going to be turning those people away.
Oh, no, we wouldn't turn anyone away. When you come to our shop, I try to make sure that everybody is welcome. I try to make sure that they're getting the best product. So we would not turn anyone away. So even though we cater more to medicinal patients, students, anyone is welcome as long as they understand that we try to educate more so than just purchase a product. So we're not the type of shop that is pushing and say, hey, I want you to buy this. I want you to get the best product and have the best experience when you come to our shop.
Do you think your overall customer base is going to grow after the legalization takes effect January 1st?
I think it will, but, you know, like with the average smoke shops, you can't advertise the way you can with any other retail shop. So a lot of it is word of mouth. So it's people letting other people know that our shop exists, people letting other people know the type of services that we provide. So for us, of course, we hope it does pick up. But I think once it becomes legal, it will definitely increase.
Recreational cannabis will be legalized beginning January 1st.
What makes a sin deadly?
Envy, I think, is my favorite sin. There's something so imaginative about it.
Pride leads to a lot of problems.
Greed is being a sociopath.
But with lust, who doesn't feel lust for life? And how can we tell someone not to feel lust?
I'm Guy Raz. The 7 Deadly Sins. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR. Sundays at 10 a.m. on GLT. News and ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Fox & Hounds Hair Salon and Day Spa, surrounding you with care and attention from head to toe, providing a full range of hair, nail, and massage services for men and women. 200 West Monroe in downtown Bloomington. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Right now, it takes Illinois State Police forensic scientists an average of 9 months to test DNA evidence. The long wait delays justice for victims, keeps defendants locked in jail, and makes it harder for Chicago police to solve crimes. The crisis is driven in part by scientific advances that have made it easier to collect DNA evidence. That sounds like a good thing, but it creates major problems for state crime labs and the justice systems. IPR's Patrick Smith has more.
All right. Come on in. All right, good morning. Everyone ready?
In April, Governor J.B. Pritzker toured the State Police Crime Lab in Chicago.
We know that unacceptable backlogs and issues with transparency have plagued this process for far too long.
Standing alongside him at the press conference after the tour was Illinois State Police Acting Director Brendan Kelly. Kelly has made reducing the state's backlog of untested evidence a priority since taking over the state police. But he wouldn't say how long that would take.
I think it's disingenuous to try to put some number out there. This is the date when it's going to happen. That is not being honest with people.
Kelly says part of the reason for that is that a lot of the backlog is driven by challenges that go way beyond crime lab resources. Some say it starts with a fundamental misunderstanding of when and how DNA evidence should be used. Brendan Max is the head of the forensic division for the Cook County Public Defender.
So we definitely, for years, fell into the misconception that DNA would solve a lot of the problems of the criminal justice system and make guilt or innocence a matter of science, and it hasn't turned out that way.
When most of us think of DNA evidence, we think of big, obvious samples, like a pool of blood or semen in a rape kit, instances where the connection to the crime is clear. But now we can get testable DNA from a few skin cells.
So as a result of that, what you have are crime scene investigators literally collecting every piece of debris. So if a crime happens in an alley, they're collecting every cigarette butt, every napkin. They're collecting every piece of trash around the area.
That means the amount of DNA evidence being submitted to the state police for testing has exploded.
The biggest problem is that this technology has become so sensitive that it's used too much on too many items of evidence. And because of that, we have a state lab that's not set up to handle that volume of traffic.
Max says that's created this funny situation where the DNA technology has gotten better and faster, but the delays in testing are getting longer. He says on average, they wait about 9 months or longer for DNA results from the state crime lab.
There are people in jail right now awaiting DNA results.
The frustrating thing, Max says, is that often they are waiting on test results that won't end up mattering at trial. The pool of blood at a murder scene is simple and straightforward. But a piece of trash in an alley is much less likely to be relevant to the case.
You end up having testing on sometimes dozens, sometimes hundreds of pieces of evidence in cases where we're pretty confident those items of evidence aren't going to have much probative value at all.
So the state crime lab is having to test all this useless DNA material that isn't really relevant. It means cases take longer and the backlog gets bigger. That might be a worthwhile trade-off if it helps even a little bit in the effort to solve the most important crimes like rape or murder. But it turns out a lot of the DNA evidence being submitted for testing is linked to nonviolent crimes. There are way more burglaries clogging up the state police crime lab than homicides. There were even 35 marijuana cases in the backlog earlier this month. Add it all up and you get a massive backlog that slows down the entire court system, including the most important cases like rapes and murders. Cases take years to be resolved.
It does drag cases.
Adam Shepard is a criminal defense attorney. He works on a lot of cases with DNA evidence, but he says the backlog doesn't just impact cases waiting on test results. It slows down the whole court system.
Because the more a case is on a call, that's less time on that particular day that another case could be on the call. So now everything gets pushed back.
Still, Shepard says the advances in technology and the increased use of DNA evidence is a good thing for justice. And he says the solution to the backlog is simple. The state police need to hire more people or do whatever is necessary to test evidence faster. But Robin Woolery says it's not that simple. She's deputy director of the State Police Forensic Services Division.
Everybody has to work together in order to help solve these problems. It's not something that we're going to be able to do alone.
Woolery says the State Police Crime Lab is getting more cases than ever. With all the evidence coming in, the labs have to decide how to prioritize cases.
So the laboratory would first prioritize if a case is going to court. So if there's a court date, then that case is going to be expedited. So it's being pushed to the front of the list.
Does that mean that if we're going to court on a burglary, that those DNA tests would move up and bump down a stranger rape or something like that?
Well, if the case was going to court, that case would definitely become a rush. It would take a priority.
That means the more burglary cases submitted for testing before trial, the longer it takes for the lab to process more serious crimes in which the offender is unknown. A spokesman for the Chicago Police Department says the backlog hinders its ability to solve cases. He says there's a direct correlation between the time it takes to test DNA and the department's clearance rate. DNA test results could point police in the direction of a suspect, But if they don't come back for 9 months, it can be hard to put those leads to good use. Witnesses may have moved or stopped cooperating with police, or just not have the incident as fresh in their mind. Woolery from the State Crime Lab says to reduce the turnaround time, police and prosecutors will need to help reduce the amount of evidence being submitted for testing.
We are now making a concerted effort to talk with state's attorneys about only requesting those most probative pieces of evidence.
A spokeswoman from the Cook County State's Attorney says prosecutors have an ethical duty to ensure they have all the evidence needed to get a conviction. She says they are aware of the state police backlog and resource problems, and that they have a team of specialists who help prosecutors decide what evidence needs to be tested before submitting it to the state police crime lab. Woolery says she believes prosecutors are starting to hear them when they caution against overtesting.
We try to get everybody to understand, hey, listen, if you have us work the pieces of evidence that are going to be most probative to your case, and we can get that information out to you quickly, this helps you in the long run with being able to get your evidence quickly. And the other five cases that you have waiting in line can get worked faster. But at the time, everybody's thinking about their one case and what they need.
In the meantime, Woolery says they are trying to address the problems on their end. They instituted a new case management system, and they've promised to hire 10 new trainees in the DNA section. Although so far, those jobs have not been posted. I'm Patrick Smith.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The state of Illinois has a problem with its prison boot camps. Too many empty beds. The Department of Corrections runs two military-style programs in DuCoin and Dixon Springs, but the facilities are at just 12% of capacity. IPR's Dana Vollmer says lawmakers are trying to boost that number.
It's rise and shine at 0530 for men in the DuCoin Impact Incarceration Program. By 6, they're outside doing drills, scissor kicks, jumping jacks, and push-ups. Then it's time for a mile-long motivational run. Physical training is part of the routine at the boot camp. It's also used as punishment. Jason Henton is the program superintendent.
Well, that exercise there in itself is not that difficult. You can hear they're kind of winded. Just simply going to and from the exercise position is tedious.
These exercises are just one of the ways Illinois' correctional boot camps look to instill military-style discipline. Offenders march to and from assignments. They can only speak when spoken to and must address everyone as sir or ma'am. On the other hand, they get out sooner. The program in DuCoin is designed to last 120 days. But not a lot of offenders are getting sent to boot camp. When I visited last month, DuCoin had just 28 men. The facility can hold up to 300.
So housing units. This is a traditional
We are walking between one of two identical dorms. The current population does not even come close to filling it. In the other dorm, mattresses are piled head high in the corner. Henton says it's been like this for a few years. Under current law, a judge must recommend an offender for boot camp. That hasn't been happening, and supporters say it's because people don't even know the program exists. Illinois lawmakers want to fix that by requiring a judge to say yes or no to boot camps in all cases where the offender is eligible. But criminal justice experts say low participation has more to do with who qualifies in the first place. Offenders can only go to boot camp if they're between the ages of 18 and 36, convicted of a nonviolent crime, and sentenced to fewer than 8 years in prison. Dave Olson, a criminologist at Loyola University Chicago, says there's been a shift away from sending people like that to prison. Instead, they get probation or held in the county jail. He also says the popularity of boot camps peaked in the 90s, after the Gulf War.
It was based on a false premise that what criminals need is the kind of discipline you get in a boot camp. You know, we're going to humiliate them, we're going to shave their head, we're going to yell at them, which appeased the public, because at the time that was what the public wanted, was punishment and retribution.
Back at DuCoin, Superintendent Henton says his boot camp has evolved with the times.
We have a kind of a therapeutic treatment community now. And I promise you, in 1998, when I was an officer here, we did not have that. We were drill sergeants, and security was first, and you didn't have any feelings, and it didn't matter what you were going to do on day 121.
Offenders spend hours each day in programs on substance abuse, anger management, fatherhood, and more. Dustin Michaels is at DuCoin for meth possession. He says the physical training is helping his body recover from drug use, and for the first time, he's getting addiction counseling.
Being with other people that have been in the same situation helps out a great deal. When you haven't been through it, you don't know. You know, you kind of feel isolated, alone. To know that there's other people with the same feelings and to see how they get through it helps out a lot.
Olson, the criminologist, says it's these kinds of services, not the paramilitary structure, that reduce the likelihood someone will commit another crime. But he says research shows the benefits of boot camp are short-lived. Long-term, recidivism rates stay almost the same.
If it doesn't reduce recidivism or anything like that, what it does do is it shortens the length of time in prison.
That might have value for a prison system that's as overcrowded as Illinois' is. But Olson says selling it as a crime reduction strategy doesn't hold much water. I'm Dina Vollmer.
Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. WGLT.org is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Mary Cullen and our friends at IPR. Thanks to Normal Mayor Pro Tem Kevin McCarthy as well for stopping by. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. And if you are a podcast fan, we have a bunch of new ones to subscribe to. We have spun off GLT's McHistory, Center Stage, and the Next to Normal Story Slam into their own podcasts. You can find those on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Comment on our Facebook page, we're WGLT-FM, or follow us on Twitter. We're all at WGLT News. This is 89.1 and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.